We're going to begin today's program by giving you a little information about the J.P. Morgan Banking Company. Most everyone has heard the name J.P. Morgan and connects that name with a large and powerful banking firm. Few people know that J.P. Morgan began as George Peabody & Company. George Peabody began in business in 1814 in Georgetown, D.C., operating as Peabody Riggs & Company, dealing in wholesale dry goods, and in operating the Georgetown slave market. In 1835, George Peabody established a firm in London. Soon after arriving in London, George was summoned to an audience with the gruff Baron Nathan Mayer Rothschild. The aristocracy of London did not like Nathan Rothschild very much and often refused his invitations. Rothschild proposed that Peabody, a man of modest means, be established as a lavish host whose entertainments would soon be the talk of London. Rothschild would pay all the bills. Peabody accepted. His parties became quite popular with the upper crust as they amused each other with jokes about the crudities and bad manners of Nathan Rothschild without realizing that all the wine, champagne, and other liquor they drank and all the fine food they ate had been paid for by Nathan Rothschild. Peabody soon became the most popular host in London. Peabody also became quite an astute businessman, buying and selling on both sides of the Atlantic. His American agent in the United States was the firm headed by Junius S. Morgan, father of J.P. Morgan. Peabody never married, so he had no heirs to succeed him in business. He was very impressed with the tall, handsome Junius Morgan and persuaded Junius to join him in London as a partner in 1854. Peabody had made a good choice with Junius as his successor because Morgan continued the secret relationship with N.M. Rothschild. When the Civil War came on, George Peabody and Company were appointed the financial representatives in England of the United States government. Their wealth suddenly began to pile up. The Springfield Republic newspaper of Springfield, Massachusetts in 1866 said that the Peabody and Company participated to the fullest in the common English distrust of our cause and our success, and talked and acted for the South rather than for our nation. No individual contributed so much to flooding our money markets and weakening financial confidence in our nationality than George Peabody and Company, and none made more money by the operation. Junius Morgan began shipping large quantities of Peabody iron to the United States, which was used for much of the railroad tracks in this country from 1860 to 1890. In the book, The Life of J.P. Morgan, Corsair tells us that the panic of 1857 was caused by the collapse of the grain market and by the sudden collapse of the Ohio Life and Trust. That caused a loss of $5 million. 900 other American companies went under at the same time. You may recall 2 programs ago we mentioned how the ship Central America sank with $4 million in precious metal, forcing the Ohio Life and Trust Company to go bankrupt. This resulted in the banks suspending redemption of their notes on October 13, 1857, causing business failures from $291 million in 1857 alone. What was not mentioned on the last program is that one company survived and flourished. That company was George Peabody and Company. With the cash advance from the Bank of England of $100 million, Peabody and Company purchased depreciated securities of real value that had been thrown on the market and later sold them at a large advance when sanity was restored. This money came from the Bank of England, which was run by Baron Nathan Rothschild, and no other firm received such benefits during this panic. In the book Pierpont Morgan and Friends, The Anatomy of a Myth, author George Wheeler tells us that there was an extensive anti-Rothschild development in Europe and the United States that focused on the Rothschild family. Even though the Rothschilds had a registered agent in the United States by the name of Belmont, it was advantageous to them to have an American representative who was not known as a Rothschild agent. Most of the listeners have heard the name J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan's full name was John Pierpont Morgan. He was born during the Panic of 1837. He preferred to be called Pierpont, which was his mother's maiden name. In 1852, he contracted rheumatic fever that left him in so much pain that he could not walk. He went into banking in 1857 at the London branch of the merchant banking firm Peabody, Morgan & Company, a partnership between his father and George Peabody, founded 3 years earlier. In 1858, he moved to New York City to join the banking house of Duncan Sherman & Company, the American representative of George Peabody & Company. During the Civil War, he paid $300 so that a substitute could serve in the army for him. During the war, he purchased 5,000 defective rifles at $3.50 each from the army and then sold them to an army general for $22 each. He was also paid by the government before he sold the condemned rifles to the government. His grandfather, Joseph Morgan, was a well-to-do farmer who owned 106 acres in Hartford, Connecticut, and in 1819 was one of the founders of the Aetna Insurance Company. Although the London house of Junius S. Morgan and Company continued to be the dominant branch of the Morgan enterprise, with the death of the senior Morgan in 1890, John Pierpont Morgan became the head of the firm. After operating as the American representative of the London firm from 1864 to 1871 as Dabney Morgan Company, Morgan took on a new partner in 1871. This new partner was Anthony Drexel of Philadelphia, and they operated as Drexel Morgan & Company until 1895. Drexel died that year, and Morgan changed the name of the American branch of the company to J.P. Morgan and Company. In 1892, Morgan arranged the merger of Edison General Electric and Thomas Houston Electric Company to form General Electric. In the Panic of 1893, the Federal Treasury was nearly out of gold. President Grover Cleveland accepted Morgan's offer to join the Rothschilds to supply the U.S. Treasury with 3.5 million ounces of gold in exchange for a 30-year bond issue. This saved the Treasury, but hurt Cleveland's standing with the agrarian wing of the Democratic Party and became an issue in the 1896 election when banks came under attack from William Jennings Bryan. Morgan and Wall Street donated heavily to the Republican candidate, William McKinley. In 1899, J.P. Morgan went to England to attend the International Convention. When they returned, J.P. Morgan had been appointed head representative of the Rothschild interest in the United States. As the result of the London Conference, J.P. Morgan & Company of New York, Drexel & Company of Philadelphia, Grenfell & Company of London, Morgan Harges C. of Paris, M.M. Warburg Company of Germany and America, and the House of Rothschild were all affiliated. This also allowed the Rothschilds to hide their activities in the United States under a less well-known name. After financing the creation of the Federal Steel Company, Morgan merged it in 1901 with the Carnegie Steel Company and several other steel and iron businesses including Consolidated Steel and Wire Company, to form the United States Steel Corporation. At the height of Morgan's career during the 1900s, he and his partners had financial investments in many large corporations and had significant influence over the nation's high finance and Congress members. The Panic of 1907 was created by Morgan to wipe out the banking, iron industries, and shipping of Heinz Morse Group. The panic was initiated when the brokerage firm of Moore and Sheely was deeply involved in a speculative pool in the stock of the Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad Company, and Sheely had pledged over $6 million of the Tennessee Coal and Iron stock for loans among Wall Street banks. The banks had called the loans, and the firm could not pay. If Moore and Sheely should fail, 100 more failures would follow, and then all Wall Street might go to pieces. Morgan decided they had to save Moore and Sheely. The panic was alleviated when the Morgan-controlled U.S. Steel bought the TCI stock from Moore and Sheely. Judge Gary, head of U.S. Steel, agreed, but was concerned there would be antitrust implications that could cause grave trouble for U.S. Steel. Morgan sent Gary to President Theodore Roosevelt, who promised legal immunity for the deal. U.S. Steel paid $30 million for TSI stock, and Moore and Sheely were saved. The announcement had an immediate effect, and by November 7, 1907, the panic was over. Not only did he stop the panic of 1907, he was the leading financier of the Progressive Era, and his dedication to efficiency and modernization helped transform American businesses. Morgan was considered an American financier, banker, philanthropist, and art collector who dominated corporate finance and industrial consolidation during his time. But despite the large number of mergers and the growth in the absolute size of many corporations, the dominant tendency in the American economy at the beginning of the 20th century was toward growing competition. Competition was unacceptable to many key business and financial interests. As new competition sprang up and economic power was diffused throughout the expanding nation, it became apparent to many important businessmen that only the national government could rationalize the economy. Ironically, contrary to the consensus of historians, it was not the existence of monopoly that caused the federal government to intervene in the economy, but the lack of it. In the long run, key business leaders realized they had no vested interest in a chaotic, competitive industry and economy in which not only their profits, but their very existence might be challenged. John D. Rockefeller was supposed to have said that competition is a sin. August Belmont, you see, was not the only agent of the Rothschild bankers in the United States. Another agent was J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan financed Simon Ox, who owned the Chattanooga Times, and secured the financing of Ox to purchase the New York Times. Even as England's political and military power was waning, her financial power was increasing. Under the surface, the Rothschilds long had a powerful influence in directing American financial laws. The law records show that they were the powers in the old Bank of the United States, which was abolished by Andrew Jackson. Well, that was just to give you a little insight into J.P. Morgan that you may not have already known. Now we're going to cover the establishment of the Federal Reserve System, which J.P. Morgan and Company, through the Rothschilds, had great influence in. In 1910, a group of men boarded a private railway car in Hoboken, New Jersey. Although some newspaper reporters discovered these activities and went to the station, They left with blank notebooks and no stories because none of the men in the private railroad car, although well known, would talk to the reporters. The private train car was owned by Senator Nelson Aldrich. Senator Aldrich had a grandson named after him who would later become Vice President of the United States. His name was Nelson Rockefeller. Nelson Aldrich was, at that time, head of the National Monetary Commission. This commission was created by Congress to study monetary reform in response to the public feeling against big bankers, especially the Eastern bankers after the artificial panic of 1907. The commission had toured Europe to study financial practices of that continent's countries. The tour had taken 2 years and cost the taxpayers of this country $300,000. $300,000 was an extremely large amount of money at the beginning of the 20th century, but since his return, Senator Aldrich had made no effort to report to Congress or to provide a solution to the recurring panics which the nation had suffered since the Civil War. Traveling with Senator Aldrich was the senator's private secretary, A. Piatt Andrew, a professional economist and assistant secretary of the Treasury. He was also a special assistant to the National Monetary Commission. Other members of the party were Charles D. Norton, president of Morgan's First National Bank of New York, and Henry P. Davidson, senior partner of J.P. Morgan & Company. Also aboard was Benjamin Strong, a lieutenant of J.P. Morgan. Benjamin Strong had become well-known during the 1907 recession. In 1901, Morgan and Kuhn Leib had formed an alliance known as the Northern Securities Company, which dominated the country for years. This was the group that put Theodore Roosevelt in office as President of the United States in order to delay the prosecution of the Northern Securities Company by the Department of Justice. Roosevelt succeeded in his efforts and was then given the name of Trust Buster. Theodore Roosevelt accepted $500,000 in campaign funds from Schiff and Morgan in 1904 and stomped the country bellowing about what he was going to do to the trust. The trust survived his term in office, but we did get the Sherman Antitrust Act and the Clayton Antitrust Act. These acts were written by the trust for the trust to prevent anyone else from breaking into the circle after things had been set up. Thurman Arnold writes in The Folklore of Capitalism, "The antitrust laws made the big corporations more secure from popular interference because the big boys could survive the legal entanglements created by government legislation." Northern Securities was the alignment of the Rothschild Empire in America, and J.P. Morgan & Company was to be their agent. This occurred in 1869 when J.P. Morgan and Anthony Drexel went to London and reached an agreement with N.M. Rothschild Company and would become their agent. Another member of the party was Frank Vanderlip, president of the National City Bank. It has been reported that the National City Bank was responsible for the Spanish-American War. I don't know about that, but one thing is known. After the Spanish-American War, National City Bank owned the sugar industry of Cuba. In one train car were the individuals the citizens of this country feared most, the heads of the Eastern banking establishment, men who controlled the oil, railroads, heavy industry, and the communications of this country. All the reporters at the station knew was that these men were going off for a quiet weekend. The first details of the trip did not surface for another 6 years. It was a story called Jekyll Island, which was printed in a magazine. This story gave the public the first revelations of what was happening there. The entire story may never be known, but over the years, bits and pieces have been put together through biographies and statements by and about the characters involved until a pretty complete story has been told. The group was headed for Jekyll Island Hunt Club, located in Jekyll Island, Georgia. The club was owned by John D. Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan. The club was used as a retreat by its members, which were small in number, yet all were associated with the New York money market. Secrecy was paramount for these men. They didn't even use last names when speaking to each other, and after the meeting, this same group formed a club known as the First Name Club, which met regularly. The usual caretakers of the Jekyll Island Hunt Club had been given a 2 weeks vacation because some of them might recognize the guests who showed up at the meeting. New servants were brought into the club who wouldn't know who these men were that came into Jekyll Island for this special occasion. The reason for all the secrecy was the purpose of the meeting. They went to Jekyll Island in order to write a document which would allow them to control the money and the credit of the United States. Paul Warburg was to do most of the drafting of this document. Senator Aldrich was there to see that it was worked good enough to get through Congress, and the rest were there to offer their suggestions. These men did not want the public to know they were planning to put a national bank on the landscape of the United States. This country had been against a central bank, which would control in a totalitarian manner the financial resources we had. The struggle had begun with Thomas Jefferson's fight against Alexander Hamilton's scheme for the First Bank of the United States, and this fight had continued through the presidency of Andrew Jackson and on through the Civil War. One of the biggest problems facing the group was to word the document so the public would not suspect that it was written by bankers. Throughout American history, there was a long tradition of our people being against a central bank. That was the first thing to avoid, the use of the term central bank. Paul Warburg suggested they use the name Federal Reserve System. He believed this would allay suspicion to the public's mind. This was the only major disagreement, the naming of the bill the members had, because Nelson Aldrich wanted the bill to be called the Aldrich Bill. Nelson Aldrich had argued that the bill would arouse consternation if it went before Congress without his name on it. His name had already been associated with money reform. Warburg argued that Aldrich's name alone would cause the bill to be defeated. Aldrich was known for his tariff bill in favor of the Tobacco Trust, the Rubber Trust, and the Eastern Banking Establishment. From start to finish, the production of this act was Paul Warburg's. Wording was changed from time to time, and disagreements were few except for the naming of the bill. In a preface written for a group of Warburg's essays calling for a central bank, Professor E.R.A. Seligman of the Seligman International Banking Family and also head of the Department of Economics of Columbia University said, "The Federal Reserve Act is the work of Mr. Warburg more than any other man in the country." The title of the bill was important in order to have the document passed by Congress, but the body of the bill was important because it would fulfill the main function of a central bank. That is, it would be owned by private individuals who could make a profit from its ownership. It could control the nation's issue of money. It would have at its command the nation's entire financial resources, and it would be able to mobilize and mortgage the United States by involving it in major foreign wars. It could help out smaller banks when the smaller banks were in trouble, but its main purpose was to loan the government money. One point which Warburg wanted in the plan and which he succeeded in attaining was a uniform discount rate. A uniform discount rate is a method employed by the European banks. As it would be employed in the Federal Reserve Act, it meant that the central bank had the power to create a money panic in any section of the country it so desired. It also meant it could create a panic nationwide. With the 12 main branches and their 25 subsidiary branches, the public, for the most part, did not recognize the system for what it was, a central bank. The public, as well as the better members of Congress, did recognize the Aldrich Bill, as Paul Warburg predicted. It was defeated. In 1911, the United States had many independent and public-minded newspapers whose editors were not beholden to the New York bankers, and these editors saw the Aldrich Bill as a threat to their communities. Also, Ida Tarbell wrote a series of articles in the American magazine exposing Senator Aldrich's illegal activities and definitive history of Rockefeller Standard Oil, which showed the Standard Oil could not have had its gigantic expansion without funds advanced to him by the National City Bank and Kuhn Lieb Company. After the Aldrich Bill was defeated, John D. Rockefeller went to the University of Chicago and had two professors of economics rewrite the bill. This time, it was introduced before Congress as the Glass-Owens Bill. The bankers spent millions of dollars on favorable publicity and propaganda, extolling the benefits the public would receive with the passage of the Glass-Owens Bill. Their biggest sales point, which was repeated over and over, was that the Glass-Owens Bill would take the money powers away from Wall Street. Fortunately for the designers of the system, the public did not know who the people were that had met at Jekyll Island. The bankers also claimed the bill would create elasticity of credit and prevent undue and unfair constriction of credit. Men would no longer be thrown out of work by the fright of financial panics. The purchasing power of the dollar would remain constant. Banks would no longer fail. Farmers would have plenty of credit when they needed it. More publicity stated that the act would establish government-controlled banking institutions which would provide funds to meet extraordinary demands. It would provide a currency which would expand and contract automatically. It would provide supervision and control to ensure sound banking practices and clear checks promptly throughout the nation. The Federal Reserve Act was not without its critics. One of the most vociferous foes of the act was Congressman Charles Lindbergh Sr., the father of the Lone Eagle. He was the only congressman who had read the entire bill. I'll tell you what he had to say on our next program. The Glass-Owens Bill was passed on December 23, 1913, when most of Congress was home for the Christmas holidays. It was known to the public as the Federal Reserve Act. Only Congress referred to it as the Glass-Owens Bill. Once again, we are short of time, so we're going to continue with the building of the Federal Reserve System on our next program. This is the Old Scotchman saying so long for now, and hope you join me next time on Money Matters. Thanks for listening.